process, and this law will be implemented sometime next year. But this only address, I mean, this is a step forward, but from what I studied, now we still need more sustainable funding for this law, so the government is working on another law to establish insurance, long-term care insurance. So it's similar to our national health insurance. So everyone just pay a little bit, maybe say as little as $5 to $10 per month, US dollars, then you can get, you know, this long-term, I mean, service in the future for you or for your family. So it's a huge step forward, because now childcare is one problem, but really taking care of the elderly in the Taiwanese society still falls to women's, you know, burden. So next, I'll move on to the international perspective. So some of you may know that, you know, Taiwan and U.S. Jointly signed a MOU called GCTF, Global Cooperation Training Framework, in June last year, and it aims to help, I mean, to address global issues in to like build capacity buildings, to hold a workshop or seminars to help, I mean, regional countries in targeting, I mean, focusing on Taiwan's strength. So this year we had four areas: that's women empowerment, energy, ICT, and public health. And so women empowerment will continue to be one of the pillars into our project next year. So this year, last month in Peru, Lima, the recent APEC meeting, so Taiwanese representative Dr. Jen Song and the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry jointly announced the intention to establish a sub-fund for women and the economy. So that would help to sustain the project that APEC has been doing to promote a women and economic development. And also, like this year, in September, we invited the first ambassador for global women issues, Melinda Veer, to Taiwan to attend this APEC conclusive meeting for also our very important initiative to help APEC economy to utilize ICT to help with women entrepreneurship. So by closing, I would say that, you know, from my research, I found out that quality education is really the key to drive women to have higher participation rate in the labor force, but there's still room for improvement, such as women entrepreneurship, and we really need more women to be at the decision-making level. And there's still a challenge for women to balance work and family. And however, the government is very committed to address these issues I just mentioned. And lastly, I just want to say, you know, like in Foreign Service, now we see really more women, and not just more women, we don't quit like our previous generation. And they suffer from this quota system, and then when they finally get in, they, you know, usually for family reason, they had to quit. And also for me, myself, my husband, I'm the example of women empowerment, because my husband stays at home, take care of the children, and I'm, you know, the breadwinner. And every time, you know, people know tech pro knows that our working hours is long, but, you know, every day, like close to midnight, when I drive home, I sometimes ask, you know, I really want to be with my kids, so what if I chose to stay at home? Because my husband also, he was in the army, so he also had a very bright future, but he chose to, you know, give up because of me. So I often ask this question, whether I want to be with my kids or, you know, stay in the office this late. And my answer is always, you know, how fortunate I have my husband to support my work. So I can be, you know, who I want to be. So for women, I mean, my advice is really, you just need to ask. To ask family, not just husband, you know, other families, to share the responsibilities, and not just, you can be a good mother, you know, other people can help as well, and they can do a good job, just like my husband. Thank you.
Thank Thank you so much, Gloria, for not only the overview on what's going on in Taiwan, but some insight into your personal life, because I think that illustrates a question I wanted to ask first Shihoka, but also open it up to the other panelists. Sort of, what are the regional broad challenges that we see to bringing gender parity, not only in the workforce, but in our homes, and the unforeseen obstacles such as, okay, if my husband's willing to take on more housework, but then I never see my children, you know, what is a better solution beyond these sort of bureaucratic policies that have been put into place? So I was wondering if, Shoko, if you had any thoughts, and if not, I could, or if you wanted to take a moment, but as you thought about it, if anyone else wanted to have some input?
Yeah, go ahead. First of all, thank you, especially to Gloria for that really great insight into your own challenges. I think all of us here have faced challenges. And Abigail talked about the challenge of cultural resistance. And really, the key here, I believe, is going to be social change, or lack thereof. I recently had dinner with a very prominent Japanese journalist. He was here to meet with very senior officials with the U.S. government. Big talks about the U.S.-Japan alliance and all that. But then, over dinner, he meets with these senior officials, and invariably they'll talk about personal issues. And these senior people will talk about their wives or their husbands. And his comment to me was, you know what, America values power couples, especially in Washington. If you are a prominent man in Washington, it's most likely that your wife is going to be a very prominent player in Washington, and vice versa. I never really think about this, except when I'm in Washington or New York, because whilst I'm in Japan, I'm in big G's, I'm very proud of what I do, but when I come here, I'm kind of embarrassed because I have to say, well, my wife, what does your wife do? My wife stays at home, and I'm very proud of her, but I feel a little bit embarrassed by admitting this. So that to me was interesting, and I hope my comment to him was, well, I hope you do something about it, because I know your wife is good at it, and I'm sure she would want to go back to the labor market and do things, and you need to be the good husband and allow her to flourish. But two things. I applaud the efforts that the Abe government has done in trying to get more women back into the workforce and really raising the visibility of this issue. But building daycare centers is not enough. Tax credits and tax breaks are not enough. I say that as the mother of two children. Children, believe it or not, they grow up. Eventually, they don't need daycare. They will outgrow the system, but they still need their parents. They probably need their parents more than ever as they grow up. And so the need for workers to have flexibility in their place to be there for them will continue. And on the other hand, we have this demographic challenge, the elderly challenge, where the strain on the generation of those in their 30s, 40s, 50s of caring for children on the one hand, who even at age 13, 14, they really need their parents. and then looking after the parents is a huge strain. So there needs to be a more comprehensive approach to physically providing those needs, but also a change in the workplace mindset in giving greater flexibility and greater ability to adapt to the needs of their workers. The second point there goes back to the conversation I had with the journalist, namely this whole idea of power couples and people in the United States, we use the example of doctors used to marry nurses, but now doctors marry doctors. In Japan, one of the biggest divides in society, I think, will come from those who have full-time employment with good employers and those who do not have good jobs, who are working part-time, who do not have very good benefits. And so that divide will become even greater there is that risk if we do move forward with this gender parity issue, that we will even see a greater divide. How do we address those social challenges? The social challenges of the United States are more about those who are able to adapt to globalization and those who are not. In Japan, elsewhere, it will increasingly be becoming about full-time versus part-time work.
Yeah, thanks. I'd just like to add to that. We should talk later because my husband, left his career to take care of the kids, and he was a huge support while we were raising our three children. And you're right, teenagers need parents, whether they know it or not. it's interesting. I was just last week representing the Asia Foundation at the World Assembly for Women WOW conference in Tokyo. This is a conference that Prime Minister Abe started 3 years ago. This is the third time to put the focus on. It's kind of both things, both, women, empowering women globally, but also with a strong focus on how to do that in Japan as well, and how to bring the issue. And there were two things that happened on the panel. I was on the panel on women and leadership, and two things that happened that I thought were so powerful and so interesting. One was Ms. Uchinaga, who is with IBM. I think she's on the board of IBM. She's really known as one of the most influential business women. She gave this rousing pep talk to women in Japan that basically her bottom line is, you keep hearing how tough it is to be a manager, and all the male managers are saying, oh, this is so tough, it's really hard to do. And it's true, that's one of the reasons why women, not just in Japan, but are kind of around the world, are sort of scared of taking on management positions because we're wondering, well, if we do this, how are we going to handle the children, right? How are we going to handle both of our things? And she said, don't believe a word of that. It is great to be in charge, And it was just, right, you could just see the audience, people lighting up that, and it's, of course, it's true. It's so much easier to, when you're in charge, there's a lot of work, but there's a lot of work when you're not in charge, and there's the stress of not being in charge. So I just thought that was lovely. The second thing that was really interesting was the governor of Mie was also on our panel. I was looking up his name later, that's right. A.K. Suzuki. And he talked about his wife, who is actually more famous than he is, because his wife is won medals at the Olympics for synchronized swimming, and so it's a little of what you were talking about, power, sort of, and you could tell everyone thought that was really cool, and he was excited to share this, and everyone was laughing that here's the governor of Mie saying, you may not have heard of me, but you've heard of my wife. And those things are wonderful, and they're important. I go back to this three-legged stool, that the economic piece is, the government is focusing on the issue, they're trying to make changes. I agree that the changes are not happening fast enough. Will they ever be able to happen fast enough to address the economic issue? I don't know. But those other two pieces are this women in business, this diversity issue, which is what Uchinaga-san was also kind of touching on, and the human rights issue. So so these conversations where people talk about things. One of the things that I'm trying to do with my company, the Wisteria Group, is we've been doing interviews of women entrepreneurs, of people around the world. A woman in Costa Rica who runs a small factory, food processing factory. But my goal is to get those things translated into Japanese and into the Japanese media market, because women and men in Japan need more models of how to do things. The woman I mentioned in Costa Rica does Ironman running and all that stuff, and she has kids. So a woman in Japan at this stage in 2016 is probably not going to be able to look to her right and left and see role models like that. So to the extent we have more of these voices in Japan, that will work. I don't think, you know, usually when we do these talks, we talk about the numbers, you know, this is for professionals, we're supposed to do this. But when we're talking about gender empowerment, and specifically with Japan, but around the world, is that cultural piece, that story of, you know, how you're dealing with it, this story of how all of us are dealing, they are key to helping move along cultural shifts.
Right. So I think this is not just the government's job. I think the private sector gradually realizes it's really their benefit to help women to cooperate this, you know, work and family balance. So for instance, in Taiwan, I mean, we several big companies like Foxconn or TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor, they all offer very good incentives to, you know, to their female employees. From 2,000 to $4,000 incentives for, you know, not only that, it's guaranteed when you come back, you can come back to the same position. So that's very important. So I think government subsidy or like a nursing, you know, facility is one thing, but it's really the employer who also need to do their part. But then one of the main obstacles for Taiwan is that, you know, most of our companies are small and medium enterprises. So I talked to my high school friends who now already have babies and re-enter the market, but they said, you know, because our companies are so small. Actually, I think 97 of the companies in Taiwan are SME. So it's really impossible for their employers to guarantee a job or give you like 2 months or up to 6 months leave. So usually for them, you know, when they are about to, deliver, then they will ask for 6 months leave and they know they will never come back. They would do some kind of like a voluntary, you know, quit, some of that kind of thing. So that's still something, I don't have a solution, but it's just something that small SMEs can cope with. Mm-hmm.
Both Gloria and Abigail, and it's about having numerical targets. So we talked very briefly about taxation and tax incentives, but one of the success in Taiwan in terms of political representation is the fact that they have had numerical targets of having representation. Is that something that would continue to be a driving force both in politics and in business? And I don't know this with Abe's plans for it's not enforced, but there are targets that Abe is having in the private sector. Do they work?
So it's funny because at this WOW conference, I brought up this very issue. And you know, usually when I give talks, most of the Japanese people in the audience are sort of nodding or whatever. And there I sat there and I said, you know, the real way to get women in the workforce or women in government positions is to have quotas. And it was like, you know, all of the Japanese participants basically, well, no, I take that back, not all. The moderator then polled the audience, which was a Japanese audience, saying, how many of you believe in quotas? And I would say about a third of the audience, which is pretty good, said quotas are not about it. Let me talk a little about quotas. So there are three things one needs to really, for women in leadership, for women to have influence in any business or government office. One is you have to have the sufficient numbers. If you just have one woman somewhere, they're not going, and this is true for any, by the way, this is a diversity issue. I think, you know, any diverse workforce, if you just have one diverse representative, in this case we're talking about women, they're not going to be able to have the impact that diversity should bring. So numbers are key. The second thing is giving them a position that allows them to have influence. And the third is to make sure that that they are empowered once in that position. It doesn't do any good to be a vice president of something if everyone is just working around that person. So the numbers issue is key. And this is the reason I bring up quotas is because there is evidence. This is, you know, there is scientific evidence, that statistical evidence, that quotas work. If you want to bring more numbers in, you have a quota and it works. So let's think about this. If we said to people, you know, you have this disease, and if you take this medicine, you will no longer have this disease, and people would say, well, actually, I don't believe in that medicine, people would think that's a little strange. So I just sort of, my goal with the quota thing is to open up the conversation a little. There's a little bit of a taboo of quotas. Obviously, you don't want to have quotas forever. Quotas are a transition phase. What the Japanese government has tried to do is recognizing that numbers are key. Having a sense that, well, first of all, I think it's difficult for any government to dictate quotas in the private sector, right? So that's why there have been numerical targets, aspirational, and then a focus of publicly listing the countries that are, the companies that are doing well on that. So in the private sector, I don't know that governments, I may be wrong, but I don't know how governments would legislate quotas. In the public sector, maybe putting on my American hat, is that they ought to be able to do that. So let's see.
Okay, so for quota, I can talk about a little bit about our legislature system. So we have in total 113 seats, and among them 34 is for, you know, at large districts. So for that 34, half of them have to be, you know, women. So actually the quota is just like 17, but now you see we have like 38%. So I would say, you know, quota is important, and we do need that in the beginning. And also, so I want to talk a little bit about how the private sector, I mean the NGO or the civil society, plays an important role in this. And because, you know, like when Taiwan elected its first female president, and in January, people were so excited, especially those thriving NGO community in Taiwan. They've been the driving force for all the regulations related to the equal working opportunities. But then they found out that the new cabinet's female percentage is really low, even lower than the previous government. It's like about, I think, about 10%. So they really, I mean, had like a press conference or, you know, joint statements to, you know, to like, or demonstration, you know, to talk to the new administration about this. And President Tsai took this very seriously. But I think it actually reflects in reality that we just don't have enough professional at the top to, I mean, be at the cabinet level. But that's something, you know, both the president, or, you know, her cabinet, and also the whole society needs to, you know, face this issue and address. But that's a very good start that we have the female president, but then we also realize that our, you know, cabinet position also needs to be more gender diversified.
And just to add a couple more facts about Taiwan. Taiwan has had a quota system in place almost since the, I think, 1946 in some way for the legislature. So this is something that's they've slowly built upon over many decades, and I think that's also why we see such a high proportion of female legislatures in Taiwan today, is because this is something that's been going on for many years. And I think that's why maybe we are not seeing immediate successes in some of these policies in Japan, is just because it will take time, but I do appreciate that they are trying. And I really want to thank the three of you for coming today. I know we're at time, but I would like to open up to at least a couple questions from the audience, but if people have to go, of course. So if you could just state your name and your affiliation, and then we'll have a couple questions.
Dave Brown Seiss, very interesting panel. My question has to do with the subject of cultural barriers to gender equality, which was mentioned, but in fact not really addressed by any of the panelists. My perception is that in Korea, Japan, and Taiwan, those cultural barriers are related to the Confucian heritage, and that all of those countries have it, but that for some reason, it appears that in Taiwan, those barriers have not been as resilient or as strong or as resistant. And the question is, one, am I right in my perception of that? And if so, why is Taiwan different?
Thank you. We are more American looking toward the model of the US. So
yeah, I think we are more influenced by the Western culture.
So that's why, like, maybe.
If I could add, I'm not convinced that it is related to the Confucian cultural context. And by the way, I really appreciate your mentioning the cultural thing because that's really what has to change for change to happen. So, but for me, I'd love to see more studies on. The reality is, Japanese women have been working for a long, long time. It's unpaid work. You know, during the farming agricultural era, you know, who was out there in the rice paddies, right? It was women. When I lived in Hiroshima in the 80s, the people in charge of the community, watch people, the ones who would tell me that I was not taking the trash out on the right days, were women. You know, all of these are unpaid positions. So women had all kinds of work that they were doing that did not involve changing diapers or education. And, you know, if I had the time, I would like to explore that because I bet that's one more myth that women in Japan don't work or have never worked. The fact is that women have been working tremendously hard in Japan for generations, but it has been unpaid and therefore unvalued. So the question for me is not how did Taiwan overcome the Confucian barrier, but how did Taiwan transition from women's work being unpaid work and therefore unseen work to women's work being in the more traditional paid and therefore seen. She would have the answer to that more.
I don't have an answer to that,
but I do want to point out that also women in Taiwan like also do a lot of unpaid work. As I said, most of our business are SME, so actually women play a very important role, like Laoban, that's the spouse of the owner of the company. So actually she involves in many like decision making, and also she takes care of like, because it's small office, so office space or even cooking or even a lot of work in the office, but she's not she doesn't have a title, but she's very powerful, influential, essential to the company. So yeah, so that's something, you know, but gladly we're seeing now the things are changing, but we still have room to work.
And I'm a huge believer in soft power when it comes to this. 2 points. I believe there is a generational divide in how work is perceived. Men and women of the older generation in Japan tend to be more conservative and more rigid in their understanding of what constitutes. The younger generation has been more flexible, not all, but many are, in part because of economic necessity, but also because of this, the influence of the media. There are soap operas that really dramatize a single mother or people workers in a single household, or there are ways to actually change the mindset, the psyche. And I think there is a greater demand for that kind of diversity of views, that not all families are the same, not all
situations are the same. There are ways that each individual needs to address his or her circumstance. So that comes back to this whole diversity issue, a diversity in value.
I think we have one more.
Hi, I'm Grace from the East-West Center in Washington. And my question relates to the impact of these government policies that are fairly impressive to see this amount of traction coming out of both the Abe administration and then it sounds like previously in Taiwan. But we're dealing with free market economies and the private sector, and two economies that I'm fairly certain that SMEs make up the largest proportion of. You're not going to hit that 100 employee limit that was being referenced.
So, how are they leading these horses to drink?
This mic is on the fritz.
Sorry, this mic is on the fritz today, apparently. So basically, in sum, how are these governments managing to induce this sort of change in the business community, and how do they go about doing that?
I know that our government has some subsidy for employers to provide childcare, that kind of thing. But now, maybe 7 or 8 hours. I'm not sure. But can I come back to Professor Brown's question? So I think I have an answer. It's still quality education. Because nowadays, I think in Asian China, girls are not allowed to receive education, right? So since now the family invests so much in the girls' education, so for instance, myself, then if I want to say, I want to just be a stay-at-home mom, probably my dad and mom would not agree because I already study abroad and then they invest so much money in me. So so if I now, as long as the female itself has the will to work, all the family or friends or the community to support. So that makes a difference.
I was just going to say in Japan there is, as I mentioned earlier, the government has required businesses that have, I believe, more than 300 employees to publish their, maybe it's called a gender action plan, so that that can be publicly seen. There are these other incentives. I was just looking, I got this at the WOW conference. Male leaders challenge to promote women's active participation in Japan, and it's a list of companies, male leaders in companies who basically have said we're going to meet this challenge. So it's these are aspirational incentives, but they do go to this cultural thing, and that the cultural change, there is an effort to make cultural change. One of the most positive things that I see is the cultural change in the young generation. I was just, when I was in Japan, there's a Japanese woman I mentor who just recently had her first baby, and she wants to go back to work. And she said, her husband is very supportive of this, which, great, and she's trying to figure out, of course, the daycare issue. And so she may not be able to solve that, in which case, Japan will have lost one worker who has who wants to work, whose husband is supportive, whose mother thinks it's a little strange that she wants to go to work, but and grandmother, by the way, to the grandmother's credit, sort of pointed out that she couldn't be the full-time daycare, which I do think is a good answer, because too often the answer to daycare problems, even in the U.S., has been, let's have grandma take this on. So. Given my age, I'm going to be a grandma soon, so at this rate, I want to make sure that no one is thinking that.
I think one of the big litmus tests will be, is this purely cosmetic or not? So companies will do things like have in-house healthcare, but because they're in central Tokyo, and you have to get on a very crowded train in the morning, that these state-of-the-art facilities are not usable to the parents. But it looks good on their glossy magazines, and it looks good on their corporate social responsibility approach.
but it doesn't really meet the solution. I think what we really need to do is actually see that in concrete action that is followed through, that actually needs, that has feedback, and if there is a daycare center, then perhaps we can have greater flexibility in commuting time, perhaps have that facility open to older children when it's on school break, things like that. And again, I do really want to credit the Abe administration for elevating this conversation, but it's not enough, it's not a numbers game. It's not just about building daycare centers, it's really about access, affordability, availability, and all of these other issues. So, but we're seeing, you know, concrete steps and greater encouragement.
So just to touch briefly on Grace's question before we close for today, Taiwan's economy in general is in pretty dire need of reform, so the SMEs issue, the small, medium businesses, is something I think the president is trying to address, not only in terms of gender dimensions, but also innovation and moving away from becoming an export commodity market. So I think that ties into the larger national issues of Taiwan, sort of how do we move on to become a country that has international brands like Japan, like South Korea. So I think that is a broader policy reform they're working on. And I really appreciate everyone for being here past 1 o'clock and for these three panelists. So if we could just thank them.